Hello, and welcome to Covered, a conversation about books with the people who write them. I'm your host, Harry Marks, and on today's show, author Robert James Russell discusses Mazzia, a novel that's been described as, quote, a shotgun marriage between classic and revisionist Western. A four-time Pushcart Prize nominee, Russell's work has been featured in StoryCord, North Chicago Review, Cartridge Lit, Great Lakes Review, and numerous other literary publications. Robert, thank you so much for joining me on Covered today.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Can you tell us a little bit about Mazzia, please?
Absolutely. Mazzia is the story of Confederate deserter Everett Root as he is trying to navigate the New Mexico Territory in 1863, and he is trying desperately to get to the city of Mazzia, all the while being chased by a one-time friend hellbent on revenge.
Would you mind reading a little bit from the book, please?
My pleasure. I'm going to read just the first little part from a chapter called A Survey of Stolen Goods.
Okay.
The next morning, Everett walked down a hillside from the mountains, leading his horse by the reins. He had run a zigzag path the night before until he exhausted the Morgan and then took a position against a sheared cliff face that looked out onto a small valley surrounded by a grove of thickly tangled cane choya and blanketed with needle and thread grass. The valley had only one entrance that he had guarded like some stern despot. Not wanting to light a fire and announce his station, he'd only slept for 30 minutes the night before, shivering under his thinned coat and dreaming of all the ways the silver could reignite his life, could give him another chance.
Excellent. What compelled you about the Western genre?
I've been obsessed with Westerns since, not childhood, but adolescence, I guess I could say. And to me, it was always the visual aspect. You know, growing up in Michigan, which I love dearly, all the green and forests and lakes and all that wonderfulness, Westerns were always set in places that were just marvelous to me, just these sparse desert landscapes that were the complete antithesis of everything I knew. And I really, now as a writer, I really gravitate toward landscapes. And I don't think I necessarily could place it when I was younger, but it was really the landscapeness, the location, the place that I really became obsessed with. And, you know, to me, I love feeling miniature in nature. I like when things can make me feel that way. So the American West, in its vastness and its oldness, it does that. So I always wanted to write something that took place there.
When the reader first opens the book, they're actually dropped into the middle of whatever's going on. You're able to jam a lot of threads into 100 pages. There's backstory we never read, but it feels like we've known these characters forever from the first time that we meet them. How are you able to drop the reader into the middle of everything? You know, right? I think when we start, Everett is standing next to someone who's dead. They've got the silver ore on them. And he's already on the run. You know, how were you able to do all of that without the reader worrying about what they might have missed before they got there?
Well, I think, you know, in the case of Mazzia, there is an invisible half of this book that exists somewhere in my head before the actual book exists. And I think when I was working on it, fleshing out backstories, fleshing out how Everett got to that moment, and you're right, it starts in medias res. He's already on the run. He's already has a bullet in his leg. I don't think that's a spoiler. That's in the first page. So, and, you know, he finds this hunk of silver and he thinks, okay, I'm going to get to Mazzia and I have an even better shot of kind of starting my life over there. But to me, it was creating in my head the backstory. I knew everything leading up to where the novel starts. So I think because I knew that, I was able to dole out little pieces and bits here and there as I write. Never enough, never a lot or too much, but enough to keep the action going and not slow it down, but also kind of feed into our desire of wanting to know who Everett is and who his pursuer is.
And from the get-go, we're urged to root for Everett. You know, he's the first one we meet. He's already wounded, and he's in this place of vulnerability, being pursued by this phantom villain we don't really meet until the end. But at the same time, we're only seeing his side, and when, you know, as the book goes on, we learn why he's on the run, and the villain, you know, to himself, he's the hero of his own story. So how are you able to craft that kind of anti-hero for people to root for, at the same time knowing what they know later on that, you know, maybe we shouldn't have been rooting for him the whole time.
Well, I wanted to flip the idea of a classic kind of revenge story on its head, because usually when we read or watch revenge stories, it's about the hero needing to get revenge, retribution in some way. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to flip that and show this kind of gray area in between. And it's one of the reasons, another one of the reasons why I love Westerns so much is, you know, they, as far as I'm concerned, birthed the anti-hero in literature and film. You know, although at the beginning of Westerns, good guys were all white, bad guys were all black, but it shifted. And suddenly you have these really, you know, morally confused people who aren't necessarily bad, who aren't necessarily the good guys, the, you know, the white knights. They're somewhere in between, like we all are. And people really, I think, glob onto that because, you know, reading just about the white knight is boring. And I don't want to necessarily humanize a straight up villain. That's not what I wanted to do here. I guess I wanted to show the gray area in between and flip again that kind of revenge pursuer story on its head. So we identify with Everett because we only ever get his perspective. And as the story goes on, as you said, we learn more about what he did. It doesn't necessarily make us hate him, but I think it definitely puts his actions in a new light,
right,
which I think is a great thing to do. And I think that's another reason why, as you were saying earlier, the story is satisfying in 100-plus pages. It's because, you know, there is this kind of revolution that happens. We go all the way around and come back and kind of have to review everything we just read again, knowing what we know at the end of the book.
You know, your villain is very much like the shark in Jaws. We don't know a lot about him until close to the end, and we only get bits and pieces of him and snippets of stories here and there. And then he makes his big reveal near the end of the book. What was the decision behind that, to make him this sort of ghost-like figure until the very end?
Well, I wanted to, you know, and I wanted to not take away from Everett. I mean, this is very much Everett's story. I mean, this is about as character-driven Western as you're going to see, and that was by choice. I think you can very easily make a sprawling Western epic, but that wasn't what I wanted to do here. So, you know, I played with the idea of introducing George earlier, but I never liked how it felt. And you know, like you said with Jaws, I mean, that is exactly the kind of thing that I imagined when I was writing. I mean, why is Jaws so effective? Because there's this essence of unknown, mm-hmm, unknownness about Jaws that we don't ever really get. And even though we get some of George's backstory by the end of the book, he's still, you know, a big question mark, which is far more frightening. And I really like the idea that no matter where Everett went, George becomes, his pursuer becomes this, you know, this phantasm who's always there. You don't know how he's there. You don't know how he's doing it, but he is always right behind Everett. Right.
It's almost superhuman. Like you feel, yep, like Everett's gotten to a certain point and he can rest. And then, you know, there's a gunshot right next to his head, George announcing himself that he's caught up with him.
Yeah. And I partially like that too, because I definitely wanted Everett to atone for his sins, and I didn't want him to rest. I want this book to have a rhythm to it, to keep going. And part of that was whenever Everett gets comfortable for a moment, he, you know, this discomfort is brought back on by George being back in the picture. And that was really important to me, to keep the story going. You know, there's not a lot of rest in this. There are definitely some places of rest, but I feel like there's an uneasiness with the rest that every single time gets broken up by the appearance of George. And that, again, was on purpose, because I wanted there to be a fluidity to the story, a movement to it that was constant. You know, I want you to feel tired for Everett. I want you to understand how hard it must be slugging through the desert the way he is, constantly having to look over his shoulder, dreaming of all the ways that he can kind of start over once he gets to Mazia, but still having to look over his shoulder in exhaustion all the while.
It never feels like rest. It feels like catching your breath. You're,
sure,
you're stopping just long enough to gather your bearings until you're forced to move on to the next whatever.
Absolutely.
What were your influences, other than Jaws, what were your influences in writing the book?
Well, I would say the biggest influences are the collected Western stories of Elmore Leonard. Mm. He, before he went on to write all his crime fiction, he spent many years writing Westerns, and admittedly, he told people before his passing that he did it because they paid the best, but he really kind of fell in with it. And I love, love, love his Westerns. The, you know, the anti-heroes in there, the way he presents nature and landscape in his work as this thing that man is constantly having to battle against, which is another reason why I love Westerns so much in general, is this constant having to battle against nature. So that was a really big influence. And I'm a big fan of not all Westerns. Some Westerns are not good, like any genre. But the Man with No Name trilogy has been, you know, like some of my favorite films since I was a child. You know, the landscapes, the shots, the music, the swelling. And I definitely listened to those soundtracks while I was writing quite a bit.
What is it about the Western genre that people find so compelling that allows it to endure for so long?
I think it is a couple things. I think you're hard-pressed to find another genre that deals with the landscape as much as Westerns do. I mean, there is undoubtedly every Western you will read or see features at least a scene of man versus the elements. It is part of it, partially because, you know, I think the desert really inspires us to kind of wonder what if and be in awe of this place that is just so sparse, yet life still clings to it in some way. And there's no other genre that does that. And people like seeing characters overcome odds. They like seeing characters overcome nature, especially harsh nature, and surviving somehow.
You don't think the, like, nautical fiction, like Moby Dick or In the Heart of the Sea, that doesn't also lend itself to those same things of overcoming the odds, fighting nature?
Yeah, I think it does. I guess there's less of that, so I'm not as quick to recall that, I suppose. But that is the same thing. But I think, I don't know, there's something about the desert that's different to me. Like, you know, nautical literature, you're in water, and I guess it is a desert in a way because you're surrounded by this water that you can't actually drink, right? Mm-hmm. But you're on a ship, and a lot of those stories end up becoming, you know, where the ship is more of a character than the actual ocean and the water itself is too, right? And to me, Westerns, it's the desert itself that becomes a character. They do have to survive against the ocean, yes, but there's something more personal in it in Westerns to me. Oftentimes in the stories, they lose their horse, for example, and it's them on foot. You know, we feel the pains of their steps. And again, with Everett being wounded, I wanted you to feel the pains of him walking through the desert, of going through the desert. And I guess there is that little bit of a division there in my brain, if that makes any sense.
Today's episode is brought to you by Nacht Sound Engineering. Nacht helps you record, edit, and produce great podcasts, streamlining the process so you can deliver high-quality shows to your audience. Whether you just need to trim the ums and you knows, or you're looking to set up the perfect recording rig, Nacht has it all covered. Speaking of, Nacht makes every episode of this podcast sound terrific. Consider this more than just an advertisement, consider it an endorsement. So if you're looking to bring your podcast to the next level, contact Nacht Sound Engineering today at nachtsound.com. That's N-A-C-H-T sound.com. Nacht, more than a stack of tracks. Your book, as well as many others, and movies as well, these Westerns, they're always set after or even sometimes within the Civil War, before the Industrial Revolution really kicks off. You know, you've got very few laws, if any. It's the Wild West.
Absolutely.
They've done the modern Western. Things are Justified. But do you find it that it's more difficult to set these in modern times, given that they're such a bent towards lawlessness and basically doing whatever you can to survive? As you said, the landscape is such a big part of it also, that there's so much development now over mm-hmm. that landscape that you lose some of that in the modern setting.
No, I agree with you. And I love modern Westerns, like Justified, quite a bit for a lot of reasons, but there's nothing like, I think, like you said, the lawlessness of the actual Western period. And I think that's another reason why people draw to that. And, you know, the anti-hero is present there. I think you have to suspend your disbelief quite a bit more in modern Westerns, like you said. People have cell phones. It's easier to get a hold of the police now, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, you might have a town in the middle of New Mexico with a sheriff, sure, but that doesn't mean the sheriff is necessarily going to do anything or is around. And there is that certain lawlessness, that certain anarchy that kind of just exists that is just, I think, fantastical for us to imagine, because it's so removed from what we know in society now. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that really draws me to it as well. Like, 100 years ago, even, you know, people were still living in the West that way, in certain ways. And that's just, that boggles my mind, I guess, and it compels me to want to write about it.
Was the book always conceived as you had published it, or did it go through several different revisions in terms of style and sound? And
the voice was more or less the same. Just to kind of dip into my writing process a little bit, I'm not much of a outliner. Too much. I will get an idea for a book and think on it for a long time, long time, and I internalize a lot of this, and my process is very internal that way, so it's kind of boring to talk about, I guess. But part of my process is to kind of figure out what the voice is going to be, and I think if you read any of my longer stuff, the voice for each of the things I've done, it's different for everything. And that is by design, because to me, the story needs to speak to me a certain way. So the voice of this was something I worked on for a while, and when I started writing, it kind of just, I had what I wanted, and it kind of worked from that point. And the publisher loved it, so I didn't have to work with that too much. I did think for a while of adding in different points of views, and there is a couple brief moments where we get outside perspectives other than Everett's, which is by design. I had toyed with adding more of those, but ultimately removed them because I still wanted this to be Everett's story. This could have been a novel that, you know, could have been a traditional length 40,000 word novel, right? But I don't know. I wanted this to be a book, an exhausting book about one man. And I was, you know, afraid that if it was too much longer the way it is, it would be just too repetitive and people would be too bored with it at that point. So having it this length was also by design.
Did the length and the close adherence to the Western genre make it more difficult or easier to place it with the press?
Well, the story of the publication of this book actually is unique. So I had actually, a version of this book existed as a short story that was published. And in it, Everett was very, very much a villain, actually. Hmm. And it ended, you know, it was a short story. It ended very differently. The entire thing was very different. And the publisher actually read it, contacted me, wanted to see if I had rights for it because the publisher, Dock Street Press, loves Westerns so much, and they had been actually itching to do something like that, and asked if I would be willing to kind of redo it as a novel. And I was obviously delighted to do that. That's a fantastic thing to be asked by anyone. So I took a step back and kind of, you know, pulled the curtains back on the finished story and really thought about what I wanted to express in a book, and then changed a significant portion of it, you know, starting from scratch about, you know, who Everett was, especially in his trials and tribulations and the route he takes and everything, and it eventually became Mazia.
That's great. Who do you usually let read your drafts before they go off to publication?
I have a couple close writer friends that I'll send drafts to. My process is odd. I like to make fun of my process. My process is weird. I have no, like, official training in writing. I didn't get an MFA or anything like that. So I constantly feel like the way I do things is wrong.
I feel the same way. I'm in the same boat. I never got an MFA.
There you go. Yeah. So it's, but it works for me. So I tend to share stuff as I'm writing it with people that I know, you know, more to get feedback. If you're the reader, does this work for you? And if not, why? What can I do better? What is lacking here? You know, obviously everyone does drafts, but I think I don't do drafts the way some of my friends do drafts. I have some friends who do drafts that they'll write, you know, 200,000 words of a book, right? And then scrap 100,000 words of that and then add another 100,000 words to that and go back and forth. Right. I can't work that way. Like, all I see is work lost when I do that.
Right.
So I do a lot of internal editing as I'm writing and sharing with people as I write to make sure I'm on some sort of path. Not necessarily a validation. I'm not necessarily looking for them to say, hey, this is great, keep going, nothing like that. But just, you know, I'll have sets of questions for people. Hey, what do you think of this, 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 and this as I go? And that really kind of helps me hone the book as I go. I mean, I generally already know the plot of everything, but I want to make sure that I'm expressing everything the right way.
Oh, okay. So you don't leave it open-ended so much for them. You tell them to, you ask them to focus on specific things while they're
Absolutely.
Reading.
Yeah. And the people that I have, I trust enough that they're going to tell me other things as they see them anyways, which is great. The one thing I always teach my writing students about creative writing is to have someone you trust that will tell you when something isn't working, because the worst thing you can do is have someone who's just going to tell you everything you do is wonderful, because number one, that is never going to be the case.
Right.
And not doing yourself any favors by that. So, you know, the people I have that read my work, I trust them to tell me if something doesn't work. So I don't have to worry about that aspect of it. I can say specifically I'm interested in these three things. And obviously, if you find anything else, let me know. And they will let me know. And that's great. And that's the way to become a better writer.
You teach creative writing. Where is it you teach?
Right now, I teach at University of Michigan.
Okay. And what's that like?
It's great. It's, you know, I'm some really talented students that make me horribly jealous, which is a great thing. And I always tell my students, you know, good writing should make you jealous. And it's a really weird situation when you're jealous of a 17-year-old who claims to have never written before. But it makes it fun to teach that way. And I think teaching underclassmen especially, they have this kind of desire to want to improve. And they really kind of take to heart what you're telling them. So it's really rewarding in that way. And it makes me a better writer. It's cheesy, but it really is true. It makes me a better writer.
It's absolutely true. I used to play, I still play bass and saxophone and guitar. And I found when I was playing bass in a band, I learned a whole lot more than I did just practicing by myself.
Sure.
You really have to do it with other people. And I know writing is a solitary endeavor for the most part, but you know, you're going to learn more by sharing your work with others, reading others and talking about it and really analyzing it and studying it more.
I agree. And it is a solitary endeavor, but I think it doesn't necessarily have to be. You know, I'm not really a solitary person, so I need input as I write, and that's just my personality. Obviously, the act of physically sitting down to the keyboard and writing is solitary.
Right,
for
right.
For me, the brainstorming process, the writing process doesn't have to be. And for me, I found over the years that the more cloistered I am, just removed from everyone, the less I like what I write.
Interesting. Okay. So you don't even wait until the draft is in a passable state, like you've gone over it a couple times. You'll share first drafts of your work with your trusted writing friends.
Yeah. I mean, I think, see, drafts are difficult for me, I think, because, you know, when you think of first draft, you think of the entire thing's done and this is my first draft at it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's more that if I sit down today and write 2,000 words, for example, I'm going to stop when I hit a stopping point. I'm going to go back and reread and edit everything I've done up to that point to get to a point where I'm very happy with it at that moment. Then, yeah, when I'm happy with it, I'll send it along and say, hey, thoughts on this, that kind of stuff. So it is a draft of sorts, but I kind of edit as I go as well, if that makes sense.
You're really flouting the advice everybody is always gives regarding writing first drafts. The age-old advice is write, get your first draft done, don't go back, and then once it's finished, go back and edit. But you turn that on its head, and you go back, you reread, you edit until it's where you want it for the time, and then you keep going.
Yeah, and I don't share everything. I mean, there's definitely parts when I'm working on something new right now, and I haven't shared a lot of it because I'm happy with it at this point, and I'm not stuck, knock on wood, at this point. And if I get stuck, that's really when I want input on stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if this is working. I wrote 5 pages of dialogue. I don't know if it sounds good. I need input of people I trust. But yeah, I mean, I guess I am flipping on its head, but it works for me. I think I tried all these other ways, and this is what works for me. And, you know, writing for most of us is not a, you know, full-time job. We don't sit down every day for 8 hours to write.
Right.
So for me, the way I work is if I'm going to write today a set number of words, if it's going to be a few days before I can get back to it, you know, when I start wanting to write again, I always have to go back and reread the section I'm at. So for me, if that section is not, if I see error after error, or it's not reading the way I want it to, then I won't actually add more to it. I'll be going back and re-editing that previous section, and then I'm wasting time that I could be writing. So for me, it's almost like it forces me to kind of move faster in my process, if that works, to edit as I go.
Today's episode is brought to you by FeedPress, a simple, intuitive, and powerful RSS analytics and podcast hosting platform. FeedPress is made for bloggers and podcasters. Featuring powerful subscriber and podcast download tracking, integrated newsletters, automated publishing to popular social networks such as Twitter and Facebook, a slick drag-and-drop podcast hosting interface, and everything you need in order to submit an optimized feed to iTunes. With 250 megabytes of flexible file storage that rolls over monthly, you can easily upload 4 episodes per month. Upgrading storage is easy and affordable, starting at a flat rate of just $20 for 1 gigabyte. Let's face it, you've probably thought about moving from the aging feed burner. FeedPress offers an automatic migration tool so you can make that transition with ease. Answer a few simple questions and the rest is taken care of. Your feeds and subscriber data will be transitioned into your FeedPress account, leaving you free to focus on what you do best, making content. Now is the perfect time to have all of your analytics and podcast hosting in a beautiful and unified dashboard. FeedPress offers free migration assistance and will take care of the hard work for you. Support is responsive and available 7 days a week via email. Get in touch and they can help. FeedPress now serves more than 30 million requests per month and is trusted by such popular blogs and podcasting networks as ESN, Mule Radio, Unprofessional, The New Disruptors, Beautiful Pixels, Inessential, MacGasm, The Brooks Review, 512 Pixels, and of course, Covered. Sign up today and try FeedPress for a 14-day trial, no contracts or commitments. Use promo code COVERED during checkout to get 10% off your first year. That's promo code COVERED, COVERED. Our thanks to FeedPress for sponsoring this episode of Covered. I completely understand where you're coming from. And I always go back and look over what I wrote the day before, the old Hemingway method of writing. And yeah. I always end up editing something while I'm going back. But yeah, I can't move forward until I both understand where I was the day before and where I plan on going.
Absolutely.
Today.
Yep.
You had talked, so you were on the inaugural episode of Citizen Lit, and you had spoken about being good to your fellow literary citizens. And you had spoken about snobbiness and being ashamed of reading certain genres, or why you shouldn't be ashamed of reading certain genres. And so I want to know, do you write in a genre, by all marketable definitions, the Western genre. Do you write in other genres? Do you write literary fiction, or, you know, have you dabbled in other things? And I'd like to talk more about being a good literary citizen and being good to people who may not read what you think is high literature.
Sure. And I think, you know, and I think that's a dangerous categorization that's happened with writing in the past that I don't necessarily care for. I mean, I think even my Western, and maybe you'll disagree, but even Mazia would be literary fiction, I think, in some ways.
Oh, I'd argue. For me, literary fiction was always, a lot of people describe it as prose over plot, but I think they both go hand in hand. But I think there's more of a focus on the prose and the words chosen, and yours absolutely falls into that.
Yeah, and there still is a plot as well, too. And I think you can have, you know, and I think that's the common misconception, is that people call something you're writing science fiction, for example, so therefore it can't be literary science fiction, right? It can't be literary fantasy. It can't be literary Westerns. And again, reading the first Western, and this was another inspiration from the book, but the first real modern writer writing a Western that really showed me how literary it could be was The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. That book is a marvel. And it really showed me that, okay, there can be plot and also this just beautiful language, chosen words, everything meticulous in that way. You can have both those things. Part of that is unconscious on my part. I mean, I write the way I write. I'm very careful about word selection. So I think anything I do would be considered literary fiction. But I do think there is a snobbiness. You know, literary fiction to most people means navel-gazing books, right?
Right.
And that is a certain percentage of literary fiction type things. And for whatever reason, literary fiction is seen as the, you know, the high mark you have to achieve to get people's attention. Perhaps it's because, you know, a lot of literary fiction is what is awarded awards, popular awards and things like that. You know, and things are so, you know, compartmentalized. You have science fiction that wins science fiction awards, right? You have fantasy that wins fantasy awards. Rarely, you know, what is the last fantasy book that won the National Book Award? I'm sure there has been some, and my knowledge of the winners is not that great, but usually that's not the case. And I think it's very hard to fall into these trappings. Like, why can't I write a thriller but do it in my style? Why does it have to be one thing or the other? And that's kind of been my approach for a long time, is that I've kind of always felt like an outsider because I don't have a degree in writing at all. So that's always kind of been me looking on the outside, like, why is it like this? I don't understand why it's like this. Why does it have to be like this? And maybe it's naive. I don't know. But I guess it, to me, it can be both things. It can be all things. It can be no things.
Do you think that's a shortcoming or a failing of the publishing industry? That they're so set in their, this is what's marketable and this is what isn't marketable, that they're actually losing out on some really fantastic concepts like a literary thriller?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, you're definitely seeing more of that that happens. You know, you're seeing more of that of people categorized as literary something, something, something.
Like, and I'd argue Gone Girl is a literary thriller.
Absolutely is. Yeah. Absolutely is. Benjamin Percy, most of his work, I would argue, is literary, and he dabbles in genres, which is really, really enlightening, actually, to see someone who is traditionally considered literary, but doing all these genres that are still literary as well, too. And that's been opening, you know, that opens up that kind of door for a lot of people, I think, too. But, you know, I think it is damning, and I think it's a dangerous thing because just because something wins the National Book Award, for example, does not mean it is going to be the most widely known book out there to the general public. You know?
Right.
There is a difference between the books that writers read and the books that readers read. Sometimes they're in the middle of that Venn diagram where everyone reads the book, but oftentimes they're not. And I think that, you know, the publishing industry has gotten into this zone where they know that. And that's okay. They market certain books as literary because they know awards people and writers are going to read them and the right writers are going to read them and give praises to them versus this is your quote-unquote popcorn fiction that Joe everybody's going to read, and that's fine too. It's an odd thing. I don't like it, but I don't know if it'll ever change, to be honest, because this is just how it's been done for so long.
As long as The Guardian and Huffington Post will keep publishing, you know, articles about how, or op-eds about how young adult fiction lacks moral complexity, or,
right,
you know, if you're not writing like Jonathan Franzen, you're not really writing, you know, any of that stuff, this debate will keep going on and on. And I see it on both sides. I see literary fiction writers or any type of writer really snub romance novels, but then
sure,
I'll see
absolutely
romance novelists look at, you know, turn their noses up at literary fiction because, oh, we're elitist or whatever they're seeing it as. And I just find the whole construct entirely toxic to the industry. It's we're not in competition with each other. We're all going for the same thing. We want readers.
Right. And I think it's really interesting because when you go to something like the AWP conference each year and you have 15,000 people together in a room who all generally consider themselves literary fiction for the most part, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems like you're on top of the world. Everyone has everyone. I mean, it's hard not to, like, yeah, this is the tops, right? But then you go to like a sci-fi writers convention where I'm sure there are probably 20,000 plus people there that have never heard of anyone at the 15,000 people AWP convention,
right?
You know, it's a very weird segmented reality the publishing industry is, where just when you think you can get to the tops, like even with Franzen, right, there are going to be people so ingrained in this other field over here that I guarantee there are people who've never heard of Franzen, you know, which is most of us can't imagine, right, because Franzen, for better or worse, is everywhere. But again, I don't know. I don't know how to rectify it. I don't know if it ever is rectifiable. I mean, it pushes me personally to do different things with my work and to try different things and to test different things and to play with genres and my style and see what I can come up with. So for me, it's a way for me to kind of prove myself in certain ways. So for me, it pushes me forward, which is a good thing. But, you know, it's very, very easy with art in general, not just writing, to look at what other people are doing is not as good as what you're doing. I mean, it kind of comes with the territory with art of any kind, I think. So I don't know if that will ever change.
My last guest, Taylor Brown, his novel Fallen Land comes out in January, and I was reading it, and I think I tweeted to him it was infuriatingly good. and I felt the same way reading yours. I read the books of the people who come on the show, and I'm like, damn it, forget it. I'm just closing my laptop and never writing another word. Do you think that the awards, I guess, the awards industry is doing a disservice as well? And do you think it matters as much as some people say it does?
I mean, anything that happens that gets people interested in reading and writing to me is a good thing. So ultimately, I don't want to villainize literary awards because, if someone hears about something only because it won an award, but then they're inclined now to read it, that's good for all writers. That's good. You might have a new person who wants to go out and read more books, right? I don't have a problem with that. I think it can be very difficult. I mean, it's like the Oscar thing, right? I mean, you have people making movies pandering to Oscars to get Oscars, you know, the biopic, right? Mm-hmm. People make a biopic knowing probably that if they give a decent enough performance pretending to be someone else, they're probably going to get nominated for an Oscar, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's a great film that way.
Right.
And I think that's doing a disservice to the craft. And I think that same exact thing happens with writing. Absolutely. But I guess, you know, I'm an eternal optimist. So I see this as anything that brings more attention to writing in general is a good thing. So it does do some disservices, and I'm sure I could rattle off a list of things that I don't like about awards, but you know, for every new person that discovers reading or a book or bookstores, that to me is a win. So in that regard, I guess I like it. I'm okay with it.
Given all the Sturm und Drang around publishing, what was it that enticed you about Dock Street Press?
Well, they have a vision. Everything they've produced at this point, all of their titles are just remarkable, and they're all very, very different, from short story collections to essays. And that was something that I really liked about them, is their desire to want to publish different things. Dane Barr, the publisher at Dock Street, wanted to publish a Western because he loves Westerns. And I think a lot of smaller presses want to stick to a certain type of book because they're, you know, if you only put out a certain number of things per year, it can be scary. Like, well, what if we do something entirely different and nobody likes it? And I completely sympathize with that. But Dane and everyone at Dock Street is so passionate about everything they do. I mean, I have never seen such passion before. Having conversations about where this could go and what would happen with it, I mean, it was exhilarating. It was fantastic. I have never written something so quickly, talking to Dane about Westerns and cowboys and novels and writing in general, and it was just intoxicating. So that alone knew that, you know, kind of proved to me that I was in the right place.
They also did a couple of things that I was really impressed with. The quality of the book they put out was top notch. It was published as a paperback, but given a hardcover treatment, I would argue. The binding and everything, the cover art, just really well done. And then what I really appreciated was I ordered directly from the website, and what they sent me was essentially a care package of Dock Street Press. It was, and I wasn't sure if that was because you had said something to them or if they just do this for everybody. But you know, there was a bookmark and a personalized note about the inability for the guy to pronounce my town name, which is totally fine. And I really appreciated that personal touch. I think that's something sorely missing from the Big Five, as people call it.
No, and they do that for every single person that orders a book.
That's great.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And it's a great way. You know, I think getting people excited about reading again in any way is fantastic. And these little personal touches, I mean, I can go to a bookstore. I love bookstores. I can get lost in bookstores for hours, but the publisher isn't there. So it's really at that point about you making a decision which works for you for that day, right? But Dock Street really is taking it a step further, and they're appreciative of every single book they sell. And they give these little care packages to show that to people. And I think that's a really nice thing, because we're usually so removed from the publishers that we don't realize, I guess, that they are there. And it's really nice to see them, and especially see them being so passionate about something. And as a writer, it's ridiculously refreshing knowing that still they are so passionate about the book that they're doing this.
And how much have they done to get your book out there, and how much do they rely on you to get your book out there?
I mean, they've done a lot. They've set up a lot of interviews and reviews, I was really, really happy with all the things they're doing from their end. And you know, anything that I require as a publisher to do that I bring to them, they're happy to do it, which is fantastic. But I think, honestly, I think we're in the day and age that even if you have a book published by one of the Big Five, I mean, it still needs to be the author going out and hustling on the street too. Right. That I think we're beyond the days of you being able to sit back. And I think, you know, certain people, if you have a certain name, Richard Ford, you know, I don't know if he's on Twitter maybe he is, but I just can't imagine Richard Ford, you know, hustling on Twitter. And that's fine. He's earned what he has, I guess. But for everyone else, you know, it's a big part of the game is to being out there and to get people to know who you are. So that, I think, no matter who is publishing your book, is something that's really, really important as an author. I am like the biggest proponent ever of Twitter. It is a fantastic writing community. You know, and I tell young writers too, and I'm like, even if you don't like social media, get on Twitter for the writing community. It's great. You meet a lot of wonderful people that way. You know, discover what people are reading. You can work on trying to sell people on your own stuff as well too. I mean, it's a really wonderful thing.
Do you do a lot of work with indie booksellers?
Yeah, different, you know, bookstores. I live in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and there's a bookstore here called Literati that is one of the best bookstores I've ever seen in the world. Honestly, it's fantastic. And they carry my book, and there's a bookstore in Seattle as well too. So we try to. I mean, it's bookstores are great. Some bookstores, it depends. If you're not one of the big five, it can be harder to get your stuff in the store, but not impossible. And it comes down to the hustle.
This has been a fantastic conversation, Robert. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me. This was great.
Where can people find you?
They can find me at robertjamesrussell.com and on Twitter. My handle is Don't Laugh, Rob Hollywood.
And any plans to make any more appearances on Citizen Lit or any other shows?
I'm talking to a few people, so hopefully later this year, early 2016, I'll be on a couple more things, yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. This has been Covered with special guest Robert James Russell. His novel, Mazia, is available from Dock Street Press. Thanks for listening, and if you haven't already, please leave us a review on iTunes. It's the best way for other book lovers to find our show. We also have a Patreon page at patreon.com/covered, so fans can contribute to the podcast's production. We have some great perks lined up for our patrons, so please consider supporting Covered with any amount you can. And thank you again to Feed Press and Nocked Sound Engineering for their support of this show. And remember, don't judge a book till it's covered.